Broadcasting Union v Castle Martin v Jižním Irsku promluvil dlouholetý reportér z Afriky, rozhlasu a televize BBC Fergal Keane, o svých zkušenostech z masakrování ve Rwandě před 25 lety a o důležitých principech novinářské práce. Užijte si to.
Well, the bad came a few weeks later with a phone call from the BBC Panorama program, which said to me, there's a lot of killing going on Rwanda. It looks really big. Would you be interested in covering it? And at that stage, I was a radio correspondent. I had an eye to television, you know. And Panorama was a hugely prestigious program on the BBC. And without thinking, I said, yeah, I'll do it. Because you're young anyway, you say things like, yeah, I'll do it. I said it so often. Will you go into that place? Yeah, I'll do it. And I had some idea of what was going on because we'd had, you know, we shared a bureau with other broadcasters who had people in Rwanda. And so we saw bodies floating down rivers. But nothing could have prepared me for the scale of what was ahead. And that was a country which was, in which the living had vanished. And so they were either dead, they'd fled as refugees, and you drove along these empty roads. You'd meet checkpoints of the rebel army and just the stench of death everywhere. And you know, churchyards full of corpses by rotting in empty abandoned buildings. Just unspeakable. And as we drove on in that journey, and this was, of course, the world before mobile phones, before social media. So there was very little preparation. You know, you weren't reading tweets telling you that in such a place there's been a massacre. It was a journey of incremental discovery with very few other journalists there. And we didn't have, you know, as I say, mobile phones to be able to call out. There was no signal. I think we were able to use a phone once in the space of the few weeks we were there, and that was the satellite phone at the UN headquarters in Kigali. And we followed the story of genocide. And we went through Rwanda, through the battle in the capital, Kigali, out of the country into the refugee camps to confront the leader of one particular massacre. And I remember coming out, we arrived back in Nairobi. And even though, you know, I'd seen violence in Northern Ireland, I'd seen violence in the townships in South Africa, in the war in Angola. But this was on a scale that I'd never seen before and I have never seen since. And we sat around a table, the team, there was four of us, and we tried to eat. It was our first proper meal in quite a long time. And everybody at the table suddenly started to cry and had to leave. You know, it was profoundly traumatic. It left me with questions that about what we're capable of as human beings, which I still struggle to answer, and I think I probably always will struggle to answer. And there wasn't a happy narrative. You know, it wasn't one of those ones where, like South Africa, where a good man was elected president at the end, or Northern Ireland, there was a peace deal at the end. This was too ravaged and terrible. So that was the bad.
You nearly didn't make it because of the developing situation in Sudan. So do you want to tell us what's happening?
Yeah, it's the great hazard of the job that I do is that I make commitments to people. Birthdays, speeches, weddings, even your own wedding. And suddenly something huge happens somewhere. And you have to cancel at the last minute. And so it was a terrifying 48 hours because you have a huge demonstration right at this moment taking place outside the military headquarters in Khartoum. You have tens of thousands of people there. In the middle of last night, the Janjaweed militia and state intelligence forces attacked the demonstrators. And they were beaten back with the help of the army. So you have a fracturing
society in Sudan right now and the situation changing by the minute. So I was looking at this, I was on the Today program this morning and then contemplating having to get here to speak to you, which I was really looking forward to doing. And knowing that I will speak and then have to turn around and get back to London. The reason I'm not in Khartoum is because, of course, the Sudanese government won't give us visas at the moment. They're doing their level best to keep all international media out. But we're getting a lot of information from citizen journalists on the ground and from activists. And of course, that has to go through our own verification system, because the great danger, of course, is being taken by either side in this conflict and manipulated through the use of fake news and fake imagery. So we have a pretty rigorous vetting process of video that we go through, and a lot of specialist people at geolocation proving precisely where the video is from. They're a wonderful bunch, technical geniuses, who managed to keep us out of trouble on that score.
Was your approach to story when you started out, and how has it developed since?
I think I was brought up in a very strong oral storytelling tradition. So my uncle was a writer, my father was an actor, but my grandmother was a wonderful oral storyteller. And so I grew up around people who placed great emphasis, not just on the words themselves, but the way in which they were expressed. And so many, many memories I have of that sort of, countryside kitchen where we would all sit down and stories would be told. And of course they swelled and were exaggerated in the telling very often, but there were stories about Irish history, about what happened in the locality, about relatives of ours. And what I learned was that when you were sitting there listening to those stories, you didn't interrupt. Because if there was great emphasis placed on the telling, there was an even greater emphasis placed on the listening. And so I think what I carried from that experience was, whenever I'm interviewing people, whenever I'm trying to tell stories, the most important thing I will ever do is listen to them. Very often when I one of the things that I do is a radio series, which interviews people who take a stand in life. And over the course of producing that series, I learned the absolute power of silence, of not butting in, but of actually listening to what people say. Now, how often, when you're listening to current affairs interviews, do you come across interviewers who appear to be more concerned about the sound of their own voice or the kind of perfection of their own interjections? So that it becomes a kind of, and very often male interviewers, I have to say, it becomes a kind of macho exercise in who can get the best of this encounter. And what has worked most often for me is actually silence. And sometimes at the end of an answer, not being afraid to let that silence breathe. If there's, it's my, when I'm sort of teaching younger journalists who've come into the BBC, it's my number one top tip. Don't be embarrassed by the silence. Let it breathe. Because it's so often in that gap that either a sort of recalcitrant politician will, say, what's going on here? Why is it quiet? And will rush to fill the void with something he didn't intend to say. Or, in a different context, you're interviewing somebody who's been traumatized or who's dealing with difficult memories. Don't rush in on them. Let it breathe. And, as I said, don't be embarrassed by the silence. The other thing that I learned from the world of writers, and I'm a passionate reader of fiction and of poetry, particularly poetry, is the power of the small detail. So that when I arrive in a place which has suffered massacre, this is the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. I was there in Rwanda during the genocide. And when you arrive at a scene like that, it's very easy to see only the mass of bodies. But it's the child's shoe in the corner, which is the detail, that for me is the way of drawing an audience in that might otherwise, and this is increasingly the case, might otherwise be repelled by yet another scene of misery. And I think we need to be much more creative in the way we approach stories of trauma, not with a sledgehammer in a metaphorical sense, but in looking for those small details that make a difference. I remember once also in South Lebanon during the Israeli invasion in 2006, and there'd been an airstrike on the home of a Hezbollah activist. And when we went there, it was, you know, lots of people wandering around. We got there within moments of it. And lots of people wandering around with blood and dust and people chanting. And I noticed a birdcage with a dead bird in it, which had been in a peripheral building, but the sheer, you know, the sort of force of the explosion had killed the bird. And to me, that was just, again, it's these little signs of domesticity, these little signs of what was normal, of the things that were valued in people's lives, that I tend to try and look out for. And as a teller of the human story, because that's all I am, ultimately, is a teller of the human story, whether it's happening in Belfast or whether it's happening in Rwanda or Angola or in Kosovo, Cambodia, any of the places that I've gone. It's about telling the human story. So I felt I had to go. I couldn't be living on this island and not go and tell this contested story. And so I went up in the middle of the 1980s at a time when people were still dying because of who other people thought they were. So much of my career has been trying to figure out why people kill people because of who they think they are. It's very rarely about who the person really is. And so I spent five, at times very difficult, but immensely enriching years of my life in the North. And I learned one big thing, is that the world which the visiting American, British, French, German journalists who would pop in for a week and then vanish, the world that was portrayed by them was very different from the one that I came to know. And the world that I found was one where, yes, there was incredible, at times, sectarian bitterness. There was murder. There was torture. There were people disappearing. There were state murder gangs. But there was also a world in which people joined voluntary organizations. A world where Catholics and Protestants strove to understand each other, where they were neighbors. There's a wonderful poem by Michael Longley, the great Irish poet, which talks about all of these people, alive or dead, are civilized. And he talks about the meaning of civilization. And not something which is about great buildings or particular forms of government, but it's about the will of people to see beyond the kind of tribal barriers that have been erected between them. And when you ask yourself why there was a peace agreement in Northern Ireland, which, despite massive pressure, is still holding, it wasn't just because political leaders or paramilitary leaders decided that they would engage with each other. It could never have held and it could never have taken place had there not been tens of thousands of people who made the courageous decision to stay in that society. And they were the people, I felt, whose stories weren't told often enough. And I think this is a critique I would make of media generally in conflict situations. We too rarely tell the stories of the people who try and hold a society together because they're not dramatic enough. It's quite interesting, if I've come off doing a long stint of television work and I'm about to do a radio documentary, I really have to get my brain into a different place, one in which I'm again conscious of the power of sound. Because in television, you can get lazy because the pictures are doing so much of the work for you. And the amount of writing you do is minimal. I mean, I was teaching some people last week and watching the pieces that they'd done. And I said, write about a third of what you've actually done. You know, television can very often carry, you know, powerful pictures can carry not very good journalists. But in radio, you will be caught out.